This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning. Nice to see so many people, a couple that I know and many that I do not, one that I just met. So speaking of meeting, you know, we say in that chant, an unsurpassed and penetrating Dharma is rarely met with. And maybe you've heard this before, if so, forgive me. But it's not that the Dharma is so rare. It's that we aren't often there to meet it. We aren't often there to meet one another. And frankly, we're not often there to meet ourselves. So this relates to my Sangha. Zen Heart Sangha has been here for this weekend, inhabiting this space. It's very strange to me in some ways to be looking around and seeing all of you instead of what I've been seeing all weekend. But we have been discussing a koan all weekend, and I had a different talk prepared, but there was so much richness that came out of this koan that I just thought I would try to tell you some of what came up, and especially around, as I say, meeting. So I'll read you this story. Maybe you're familiar with it. I've read it now four times this weekend. Every time I read it, it's amazing what comes up. We had two talks about it. This morning, everybody expressed something about it, and there's still more. And that's what I love about koans. There's always more. But this is the old woman's rice cakes. Deshan Zwanjian was a great scholar of the Diamond Sutra, but he was not a Zen practitioner. He was traveling south in search of the Dharma, carrying his commentaries on the Diamond Sutra with him. In the course of his travels, he came across an old woman on the roadside selling tea and rice cakes. He asked her, "Who are you?" She responded, "I am an old woman selling rice cakes." When he asked if he could buy some refreshments from her, she inquired, "Venerable priest, what are you carrying in your bag?" He said, "I am a scholar of the Diamond Sutra, and here I have all my notes and commentaries." Hearing this, the old woman said, "I have heard that according to the Diamond Sutra, past mind is ungraspable. Present mind is ungraspable. Future mind is ungraspable. So, where is the mind that you wish to refresh with rice cakes, O scholar? If you can answer this, you may buy a rice cake for me. If not, you'll have to go elsewhere for refreshment." Deshan was unable to reply. The old woman then directed him to a Zen master nearby. Deshan burned all his notes and commentaries the next day. Wonderful story. So isn't it wonderful that the old woman, who I can imagine in those days was probably not educated, was not wealthy. There she was by the side of the road selling rice cakes. And yet she had more wisdom than this scholar of the Diamond Sutra. He was not able to answer her question. He couldn't even come up with just something simple like, I'll have a rice cake, please. He was just dumbstruck. So many things arise. One is, what will you do when a big question comes to you, when life comes to you and serves you up with something that you might not be prepared for? What will you do? What will you say? Will you be like Deshan and, I don't know. This mind that we spend so much time with, that has us in its grasp. It's ungraspable, and we are always grasping for it. And how do we grasp? Like Deshan, we think we know something. Oh, I am a great scholar. I have commented, I have read the Diamond Sutra. The Diamond Sutra is, you know, no easy text, you might know. But I understand it, and I know a lot, and yet didn't know enough to answer what mind he was going to refresh with the rice cake. So we grasp with what we think we know, we grasp with our opinions, our judgments, we're grasping with our fears, we're grasping with our anxieties, our worries. We are always grasping for mind, and yet it's ungraspable. So how do we show up? You know, the old woman was asked probably the most important question. Who are you? As one of us was saying, that's a pretty rude question these days. If you were going to go into a grocery store and the person behind the counter said, who are you? You would think that was kind of rude. We do tend to say, how are you? Kind of interesting. And then we give this rote answer, oh, I'm just fine. I tried that out one day. Somebody at Trader Joe's asked me how I was, and I told him. He was really, it wasn't that he wasn't interested. He was really uncomfortable, though. You know, I'm not having such a good day. Oh, really? Let alone, who are you? So she was ready for Deshan. She was ready to meet him. Because when he said, who are you? I'm sorry, he's the one who asked. Who are you? I'm an old woman selling rice cakes. Well, that was easy. But really, sometimes if your teacher asks you, who are you? I know sometimes that has not been an easy question to answer. Who are you? Who do you think you are? Who do you want to be? What's in your bag? Deshan had all his knowledge in his bag, carting it along with him. What are you carting around? The poet, I think it was Robert Bly, who said that we spend the first 20 years of our life putting things into our bag, and we spend the next 20 years, and I would venture to say being a lot older than 40, we spend the rest of our life unpacking that bag, all the baggage that we put in, all the things that we think we know, or who we have to be, or how we should behave. So the old woman, she could answer him, but he could not step up and meet her. It's one of the most important things that practice has taught me, is the importance of meeting people, myself, the people I love, the people I hate. They are all manifesting the best that they can, their Buddha nature. You might not think so. We live in a time that is exceptionally divided and contentious. Perhaps there have been other times like this, but I don't know them because I didn't live in them. Sometimes I wonder what the world was like for my parents who lived through World War II. I don't know. But this feels pretty divided and contentious, and we don't even know how to talk with one another. We're so afraid of saying the wrong thing, or we're not afraid at all, and we're up in someone's face with what we think we know, and you better get out of my way. But are we really meeting one another? You know, we say, I think you do this chant too at the end, you do the Bodhisattva vows when we're all finished. We vow to save all beings. It's a very funny word. The way I have been saying it to myself for the last 10 years or so is, I vow to meet all beings. Because if I think that I'm saving somebody, then I am separating myself or putting myself above. Oh, you really need something, I'll come and save you. But can I just meet you where you are? Can I be where I am when I meet you and not be afraid? Not be so full of myself and say, I am a scholar of the Diamond Sutra. I am a teacher in Zen Heart Sangha. I am this, I am that. We all carry that around with ourselves. Can we just drop that? That's the challenge that she throws down to him. Past mind is ungraspable. Present mind is ungraspable. Future mind is ungraspable. So then which mind will you refresh? It makes me think of another meaning of, you know, refreshment, of feeding. Which mind do we feed? All during Sesshin, I was chatter, and thinking, which mind am I feeding now? I feed the future quite a bit. I don't know about you. Sometimes I feed the past, but even in the present, often we are full of ourselves or fearful of who we seem to be. We still are not, even though we call it the present, are we present? And what will you say when someone asks you, which mind will you refresh? Who is it who is here right now? Can you answer? It's so very hard to be here. So the Diamond Sutra that he's carrying around in his bag, the little that I know of the Diamond Sutra is that it's an answer to the question of how a bodhisattva should practice, understanding the truth of that Heart Sutra that we just chanted, understanding that truth of emptiness, then how does a bodhisattva comport herself? And the only answer is, for me, understanding that there is no separation between me and you and all of us and everybody else driving madly on a Sunday afternoon and everybody half a world away who might be suffering in a refugee camp, people in Florida who are trying to, you know, dry out. There's no separation. And we don't really experience that. We know that. That's what we're taught, good Buddhist students that we are. But how often do we really experience it? And my experience, I think this is why it's so important to be seen. Because when we see one another, when we look into each other's eyes, there's no separation then. We know, oh, this is what it takes. It's just to look in the mirror at ourselves, at one another. This is what Deshan could not do. And I have to say, in all fairness, that wasn't a very kind question of her. You know, with skillful means, I suppose you could say, it woke him up, so it was good for him, because actually he did go off and then study for 20 more years and became a great Zen teacher. He studied with some Zen master, I don't remember who, maybe Michael can tell us, I don't know. But he did go on and become an even greater scholar and teacher, so good that she asked him that question. And we need sometimes those difficult questions. That's compassion too. But as one of my friends said, we were discussing this afterwards, and we were agreeing, you know, this isn't a very good business model on her part to say, you know, if you answer my question, I'll sell you something. I don't know how much business she was able to do. But, you know, he went away without having anything. But actually, he went away with something really valuable. He went away understanding that what he was carrying in his bag was worthless, and it was time to burn it, time to put it down. So I know I want to leave some time for questions, but as I was leaving for Sesshin and thinking about this koan and what I might say about it, I got a poem from Jane Hirschfield just that morning. It was amazing. And I don't know if you know Jane, but she's a Zen practitioner and she writes wonderful poetry. And she wrote this. She doesn't know it. I'm going to write her a little email and tell her. She wrote this, I think, about this koan and about this issue of meeting. It's called One Life is Spent, the Other Spends Us. One life is spent, the other spends us. Rarely they touch, like a cat for the first time meeting itself in a mirror. In the world, mirrors are few. The slightest wind dissolves them. In a life, the moments of recognition are few. Consciousness does not hate or love. It neither grieves nor longs. Walking and breathing are not its nature. It is. Yet something passes and ends, grows wet in rain, and then dries. And the small bowl of kibble empties into a delicate spotted paw, a tail slightly kinked, a preference for one windowsill over another. One life is spent, the other spends us. In the world, mirrors are few. In a life, the moments of recognition are few. So as I say, at the end of our sesshin, we all shared what we took away from the weekend, from the koan, and what I take away and feel again right now with all of you who are here to sit quietly on a Sunday morning when you could be doing other things. I feel this great gratitude to be meeting all of you. Thank you. So when do you go to? About 20 after?
About 30 after.
Oh, okay. Okay. So any questions or comments? Michael.
When you read the story with the exchange, with the initial exchange, when he initially asked, who are you?
Right.
And from the reading of the story, when you read the story, I thought, well, he, obviously she was selling rush cakes there. So he didn't really have to ask who she was, right?
Right.
So I was wondering, did he recognize in her something other than just a seller of rice cakes, someone who actually could be him, you know,
right.
a teacher.
Right. Yeah. So you're saying even in that moment he already...
I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, why else would he ask that? Like, what are you doing here selling rice cakes?
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. You must be, yeah.
And then she kind of passed it back to
him. Yes. Well, it's wonderful to think about what kinds of things she might have said, he might have said. As I say, we could put the fault on Deshan, but we can also put the fault with her. You know, she wasn't completely meeting him either, kind of showing him up.
She was ready.
She was.
And it seemed like she was ready. To meet him, he wasn't ready.
He wasn't quite ready.
Yeah.
Right.
That's just kind of interesting.
So what would you say?
What would I say? What?
Yes. Huh? Which mind will you refresh when you go have lunch?
The hungry mind.
The mind
with an appetite.
Yeah, see? He doesn't have to burn all his commentaries. The mind with an appetite.
Can't even find them.
Yeah, they're somewhere. Yes.
Jill, I'm enjoying what your interpretation or what you're sharing about this is doing with me when you ask, how do we meet these questions that come up in our life?
Mm-hmm.
And someone that I'm close to may lose a parent soon.
Mm.
And for me, I haven't been this close with someone who may lose a parent like this. And I don't know how to meet the situation. There's no blueprint for it yet.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that situation. And it's vulnerable.
Yeah. And we all will be faced with that, either a loved one or ourselves with loss or our own death. Yeah. And we won't know how to meet it until we meet it. And I hope we can meet those things with our eyes open and maybe saying, I don't know how to do this. You know, I don't know how to die. I've never done it before. I hope to meet it with my eyes open. But we don't know. Yes, please.
Some of us, many of us,
meet that situation when we have children. We haven't done it before. We don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the manuals, but
it's not about our kids.
And so the what works is to be there with loving kindness.
Absolutely. Yeah. And compassion. As I say, you know, when we recognize that separation, we can only be compassionate. And children, I think, you have a one or two or more? Yeah, I do also. I think their purpose is to teach us over and over. And when you think that you're done, they keep teaching. I had an older friend. She was my parents' friend, actually, but she became a good friend of mine, and she has children. She's passed away, but anyway, they're my age, and I remember her saying to me, "It's never over." And she was kind of bitter about it. I'm just really fascinated by just, and maybe because the bond is so close, that they are really incredible mirrors. And they will tell, I don't know if yours will, mine will. Mine will tell me. Yeah. So. You know, my younger one told me when he was 16, when I went off to Tassajara for a practice period. So he said, so if, you know, you're already enlightened, what do you have to go do? What do you have to go practice? You know, he didn't know that. Of course, that was Dogen's question. But, you know, it stopped me short. I was like, Deshan, I don't know, because I want to. Yes, Kathy.
This is just a thought. Our children don't teach us, they show us.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. Because one thing I've learned, I used to be a teacher, and one thing I learned as a teacher from another teacher was that there was nothing, she used to say, there's nothing I ever taught anybody. But as one of my Dharma sisters said, no, you don't teach anything, but you can open the door. And children do that over and over again. Yeah, thank you. That's a good reminder.
Did you have a question?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I think, going back to the reading, I think the play, the location of where this interaction occurred, I think is also metaphorical as well,
mm-hmm.
On the road.
It's
likely that she could have taken her rice cakes anywhere and probably had better luck. and just the idea that on the road, just like our thoughts, they come and go. And we have to approach those thoughts with, you know, kind of wonderment. What are you? I think it's very metaphorical.
That's a wonderful thing to ask your thoughts. What are you? I sometimes try when I'm able to catch my thoughts, like I recognize them and say, I know you. I don't have to think you all the way through to the end. And that happened to anybody else? Oh, yes, I know where this one's going. Okay, next. Oh, I know that one too. I realized that one afternoon, I can't remember where I was, but I think I had one new thought all afternoon. I was watching them. Oh, that was a new one. The rest were.
Some people call those tape loops.
Yeah. Yeah.
In meditation sometimes, they get replayed.
And isn't it interesting, though, how unwilling the mind is to let that go? You know, we know that. I was thinking this weekend, that I think the mind is kind of like, Suzuki Roshi used to say, like a puppy or, you know, a cow, and you have to train it. But it's like a five-year-old child and always running around and, you know, and just never being still. That's what I was like as a five-year-old. I don't know all of you. Just never being still. Probably quite delighted with itself, but it's not very delightful to us to be caught in those loops all the time. But I think it is a question of which mind we decide to feed. And probably it would be better not to feed the mind at all. That's plenty, plenty to work with.
One of the key words in your talk was meeting. I'm wondering, could you say something about what are the conditions or the criteria for true meeting?
Tell me what you're thinking.
Please.
Well, you add. That's a good question. You know, you could say being present, but what does that really mean? You know, that just gets thrown around so much. Oh, I'm present. I'm so zen. I love that. I'm so zen. I have to tell you that that doesn't bring up the best impulses in me when I hear that. I think a quiet mind helps. I think curiosity helps. Deep listening, as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, helps. You know, putting yourself aside and being available. So often when we talk to someone, we're rehearsing and getting ready for what we want to say back. Or we're anticipating and worrying about what we might hear and how we're going to respond. But do we really listen? You know, we might feel ourselves getting defensive. Oh, that isn't what I meant. And then we've stopped listening. We've stopped meeting. So setting aside an agenda. But mostly a quiet mind, and I'll be damned if I know how to have that. Yes?
One of the things that I appreciated that you pointed to is that something about when we try to help others instead of, like, we're not trying to save them. And yeah, actually showing up. And so I think, like, for me, like, I've spent a bunch of time in Buddhist communities, and there's so much kindness, but there's something that I really value, and somebody trying to be present, but I don't know what I'm trying to say exactly, but also, like, knowing that they're not fully present, and not bypassing that in some way, Yeah, and so I've actually been practicing, like, sometimes my mind's really busy, and when I'm trying to listen to somebody, it's like, you know, I'm really wanting to listen and be present, but I'm a little agitated right now from my day. So, like, allowing myself to fully show up.
Yeah, and just by you naming that,
yeah.
First of all, you've made a connection with the other person,
yeah.
And you've gotten real and said, I really want to, and I'm not,
yeah.
Which is so much better than trying to hide it.
So I kind of think that is almost like, I think there's something, I have some very deeply practiced teachers that feel like very settled all the time, and there's something about that beautiful quality of presence, but there's also something about whatever's there, we can also be present with and not have judgment or
Yeah.
Or shame around and show up, but that's also really powerful, so we don't have to have a quiet mind to be whole. And that feels important.
That's so important what you just said. We don't need to have a quiet mind to be whole. We don't need to be a fully realized being to be whole. There aren't too many of those anyway, but we are all, so they say, bodhisattvas. We all have Buddha nature. So just owning, so you're distracted Buddha right now. But by owning it, the other thing that does, I find, is that it dispels it by naming it. Then it also helps it to kind of fade away, and then you really are there. You've already said, I'm having trouble setting things aside. And you give yourself some space, and I would imagine that then you are more present.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot more real.
You've met yourself first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's what she means in the poem, you know. She talks about a cat meeting itself in the mirror, you know. But we need to meet ourselves. We're never going to be able to meet anybody else till we meet ourselves fully. It's something I remember. One of the first retreats I went to was with Reb Anderson, and we were talking about this business of saving all beings. And I was very new to practice. I didn't know what he was talking about. But he said, you know, the bodhisattva vow is to save all beings, but you can't really save. There are no beings to save. That was very weird to me. There are no beings to save. You can't really save anyone, but you save yourself first. But you save yourself with the intention of it being for everybody else. So you meet yourself and get to know yourself and be clear with yourself because it's of benefit to everyone, not because it's just of benefit to you. That's still sinking in. So, yes.
Well, I read on the Chikoji webpage that you're a therapist.
Yes.
When you work with, say, one of your Buddhist students or in a therapy session, are you, what would be different? Like, are you teaching different skills or are you, like, what's different?
First of all, I don't work with any of my students as a therapist. So, and I try to set that aside with the students that I have when we talk. But maybe your question still is, how is that different from therapy?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I think the Buddha was really the first psychotherapist. He and all those people, whoever wrote the Abhidharma, they really are amazing to me, what they were able to understand about human behavior and the human mind. I don't think, even though neuroscience has a lot to tell us, mostly it's reconfirming what they figured out 2,500 years ago. It's really amazing. But the difference, I would say, is that when I'm working with somebody in therapy, I'm usually interested in trying to help them with their story. Because their stories are important to us. It's how we understand ourselves and our lives. For a student of the Dharma, we want to let go of the story because there's something underneath the story. That sometimes I get there in therapy with people, but that's a lot to ask of someone who has come in because she's been very traumatized or, for instance, with a child, I'm just there to witness a child. I'm not trying to really have them understand their true nature or what really is in the way or how they might adopt skillful means. I would never want to go there. But as I say, the difference with adults is that it's not about their story. It's understanding their own Buddha nature and how they can bring that forward and what's in the way and how they can drop the story and understand something deeper about themselves, about the human condition, about the Dharma. So, does that answer?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tricky, I have to tell you, it's really hard. I find that hard, like, to take that off. And people expect that of me, and I fall right into it, you know, that I'm going to help them. And I've, you know, also recognized, like with our children, there really isn't any help we ever can give anybody anyway. But we can be present and meet them. That's a lot. I mean, right now, if you just take a moment and bring to mind someone who has really met you, maybe you can see them right in front of you and how it feels to be in her presence or to be seen in his eyes. The biggest help. So, thank you all. I really appreciate always hearing the questions and discussion. I just find that very interesting to hear where all of you are. So, thank you for sharing yourself and thank you for inviting me. Our intentions equally tend to every being and place, through true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.